anything wonderful to say, but I thought it might just be interesting to discuss the following question. That if you have we all know how, if you have some finite number of systems, say three systems, we all know how to regard the three systems as one system, how to handle that. So if you have three classical systems, we have a scheme for taking the three classical systems and making a composite system out of them. And similarly, in quantum mechanics, there's such a scheme. So it's at least reasonable to ask, what happens if you have an infinite number of systems? So what happens if you have a system, a system, a system, a system, dot, 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 and you want to stand back and regard the whole thing as one big system? And I think it's arguable whether this is actually a physics question at all. I'm not sure, because you might argue that there isn't an infinite number of systems in the world, or maybe there is such a system, but it's crazy to be trying to regard an infinite number of systems as one. Well, I don't know exactly what the logical status is, but maybe by thinking about this, we can learn something about quantum mechanics. So I suppose it's worth thinking about, at least for 1 hour. So that was the question that I thought might be fun to think about. So let me just tell you what I know, which isn't too much, and maybe people have some thoughts about how to. So let's look at classical mechanics first. So in classical mechanics, a system is, of course, characterized by its manifold of states. So there's some manifold of states of the system. It's like the phase space of the system. And if we have several systems, say two systems, and we want to regard the two classical systems as one, then the manifold of states of the combination is just the product of the two manifolds. So by taking product two manifolds is the set of all pairs consisting of one point in this manifold and one point in that manifold, suitably made into a manifold, and that's indeed the right place to consider the combination of the two systems. So if we want to do an infinite number of systems, we have to worry about taking the product of an infinite number of manifolds. So one way of saying that would be to look at the formal definition of the product. So the formal definition is, given manifolds M1, M2, dot, 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 then a product of those manifolds is a manifold M, together with smooth maps down to these guys, such that, given any other manifold M hat, together with smooth maps down this way, there's a unique smooth map this way that makes the diagram commute. That's the fancy definition of the product of manifolds. And if you do this for finite numbers, you get the usual product of finite dimensional manifolds. So you might think this is the sort of magic way of combining infinite numbers of systems. And this, I claim, is physically a very nice thing to do. For example, so the definition is, given a list of manifolds, a product consists of a manifold M together with smooth mappings down to these guys, such that given any manifold M hat together with smooth mappings down to these guys, there's a unique mapping this way that makes the diagram commute. So just for instance, let's consider the case when M hat is equal to the reals. So if M hat is equal to the reals, then these maps are just curves in these individual manifolds. And this map is a curve in M. So the universal property in that case says, given a curve in each of these manifolds, it must parlay itself to a curve in the combination. And that's what we would wish to have be true physically. Because if this system is undergoing its dynamical evolution, which would be a curve in the manifold of states of this system, and this one undergoes its dynamical evolution, and so on, it should be true that if we put all these guys together, the whole system undergoes its dynamical evolution. That is to say, there should be a curve in here which reflects the curves in the individual guys. So this is a sort of schema. But the problem with this schema is, what are these objects going to be? Because whereas in the finite dimensional manifolds, there's only one definition, basically, for infinite dimensional manifolds, there's lots of candidates for definitions. And we have to worry, is this going to be a Banach manifold or a Hilbert manifold or what kind of a manifold? And my sense is that there's no reasonable kind of manifold for which there exist products. And therefore, there's no reasonable notion in physics of combining infinite numbers of systems. That's what my. So let me just give you two examples to show you why that sense is what it is. So the, a key property of the manifolds that you do physics in is, I claim, a key property is that every smooth vector field in the manifold has unique integral curves, possibly short, but unique integral curves. And that, it seems to me, is a key feature of doing physics, because generally the smooth vector field gives the dynamics of the system. There's a vector field in the manifold of states that describes the dynamic, and the integral curves are the actual dynamics of the system. And you'd better have unique integral curves, otherwise you won't have unique dynamics for the system. So it seems that this is a reasonable condition to impose on the manifolds. And the fact of the matter is that for infinite dimensional manifolds, some of them have this property and some of them don't have this property. So let me give you just an example to show you, first a physical example and then a mathematical example. So a physical example is, let's consider a sequence of mass points connected by springs. And so on, and so on. OK, so that's the system. And now we can characterize this location by x1, this location by x2, and this one by x0, I guess. And then this is x minus 1, and so on. So we can characterize the state of this system by giving all these x values. And the equation of motion will be xn double dot equals k times xn plus 1 plus xn minus 1 minus 2xn. So this is just the equation of motion for the spring guy. So you might say, well, this looks like a pretty decent system. We got a nice little old equation of motion. We characterize things by what happens with the x's. This looks like pretty decent physics. So let me tell you why this is not pretty. Does everyone understand the example? Why this is not pretty decent physics. So I claim the following fact. Given x1 of t, and let's x0 of t, and x1 of t, there exists a solution of that system. For those values. And the proof is that we're fixing this motion, we're fixing that motion. Okay? So let's look at the motion of this particle. Well, if you look at this equation, it involves x2 just algebraically. In terms of the equation of motion for this particle involves x2 algebraically. Therefore, there's a unique motion of this particle consistent for this equation for that particle. You see that? Because if you write this down for x1, it says x1 double dot equals k times x2 plus x0 minus 2x1. So if you give me x1 and x0, then I can read out what x2 is to satisfy that equation. And then now I go to the next one, and I read out what x3 is to satisfy the equation, and x4, and similarly you go the other way. So there's a solution of the system for any behavior of x0 and x1. So there exists a solution having the following character, that this thing is just sitting here innocently, not moving, doing nothing whatever until 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and then suddenly it all starts wiggling, or waves start going this way and that way. There exists such a solution because I choose x0 and x1 to be the functions that are zero for the first up until 3 o'clock, and then they start moving around in some smooth, interesting way. Then there's a corresponding solution of the system. Yeah.
Boundary conditions somehow, like choosing those two functions. So instead of those two points, I could have two walls that I just say, okay, these two walls behave in some way.
So if you put finite boundary conditions, then certainly, but then you're basically doing products of a finite number of systems.
Yeah, no.
If you put infinite boundary conditions, then the kind of position is going to be you're really prejudicing the systems, because you're saying if you're giving me a sequence of systems, they're not all going to be treated on the same footing. I agree in this case there's a natural way to treat the systems on different footings. But in general, in a more general context in which I just hand you some systems, if you're going to figure out some way to describe the mechanics of the whole system, there ought to be a way that doesn't prejudice, that treats everybody equally. And so, and I'm trying to argue that naive methods of doing that don't seem to work. But I'm not really saying anything more than if you play the game with this being the system of equations, then lo and behold, you have many solutions. You have these very badly behaved solutions. Yeah.
That system doesn't conserve momentum. Is that relevant?
You're right. It doesn't conserve momentum, and there were no promises made on that issue. Right. I mean, or energy. So there's no problem.
I'm not expecting a promise. I'm just a comment.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right.
What is physically special about the system that makes it so bizarre?
What I'm trying to suggest is special about it is that the manifold of states is infinite dimensional, and we haven't been very careful about what exactly the infinite dimensional manifold of states is. To me, that's what's special. That since it's an infinite dimension, what I'm saying is you can't just say, well, maybe these problems will go away if we just ignore them. That you actually have to worry, I'm suggesting, about what manifolds you're gonna use if you want to play this game, because this one shows, at least I'm trying to argue that it shows, that if you just go crazy and do anything that occurs to you, you're going to have to face things that don't look much like physics. But I'm not claiming this system is realistic or interesting or anything, only that it's a warning. It's a warning shot across the bow.
Right. So I'm just wondering if this is related to your question. If for a general infinite dimensional system, you're not going to have a well-defined momentum anyway unless you do impose boundary conditions. So I'm just thinking, well, how would you construct a more realistic example? And any realistic example is going to be... Well, realistic example. Do you see what I mean? If you don't have some sort of asymptotic condition, then you're not going to be able to have an integral that gives you the total momentum. And then
right, but then I agree.
So it's related to your point about boundary conditions.
And the best you could offer would be some sort of mean momentum. I'm not even sure.
Which I presume would not be
coercive in this case. Mean energy.
Since I can start the part, at 3 o'clock, I can have them start racing to the left.
Yeah, no, so that's. If you admit that solution, then no mean momentum you define will be conserved. But it might be you could define some sort of global condition that the mean energy has to be bounded or finite or something like that.
Yeah, of course, this solution, this solution probably has the property that within 3 seconds will be infinite.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's... So the thrust of this is only supposed to be that on its face one has to take care if you want to combine systems. The other example of just a mathematical one just to illustrate these ideas. Let's consider in the disk, let K be a collection of all smooth functions, phi on the disk. So that's a vector space of smooth functions. And now so here's this big space K. And now let me introduce a certain vector field on this big space K. If you take any function on the disk, you can take its derivative in the direction of a translation on the disk. So if this is C, you can send phi to C dot grad phi. And that defines a vector field in the space K. It's the vector field that basically takes the derivative in the direction of C. So there'll be some corresponding vector field over here in K. That's reflected by taking the directional derivative of phi in the direction of this translation. And we can now ask whether in this space K, it's true that this vector field has unique integral curves. So we can start at a point here, and we can look at an integral curve of this vector field. So the question is, what does an integral curve of this vector field look like back in terms of the function? Well, obviously, it's just translating the function to the right. So the question is it true that there are unique integral curves of the vector field? And the answer is no, because as you translate the function to the right, new things peek in from the left, and you can extend the smooth function to the left any way you wish. So by translating the given function, this is a given phi naught, to the right, but then changing the smooth, using various smooth extensions to the left as you do the translation, you'll get many integral curves of the same vector field. So So it's just an example that shows that if you just start writing down any old space that occurs to you, write down anything that looks sort of like a vector field and hope that vector fields will have unique integral curves, it's going to be false if you're careless. So these are examples are only supposed to illustrate the idea that some care ought to be taken in doing this. And now, so beyond that, I don't, manifolds generally, infinite dimensional manifolds, big manifolds, are generally based on big topological vector spaces. And the nicest big topological vector spaces for making manifolds are Banach spaces, normed vector spaces that are complete in the norm. And in that case, basically everything we know from differential geometry is true. It is true in manifolds that are based on Banach spaces, it is true that every vector field has a unique integral curve. So if we could do this in the category of Banach manifolds, manifolds based on Banach spaces, then I think we'd be basically off and running for combining infinite numbers of mechanical systems. In this example over here, the set of smooth functions is not a Banach space. If you want to get a Banach space, you have to use, for example, CN functions, and then have the norm depend on phi and its first n derivatives. Then you can make a Banach space out of it. But if you make a Banach space out of K, then take the derivative is not a vector field. Because if you take the derivative of a CN function, you don't get a new CN function. So in this example, you have a choice. You either use CN functions, then you get a Banach space, but you don't have a vector field that corresponds to translations. Or you use C infinity functions, and then you get a vector field, but it's not true that you get unique integral curves. So you lose on all counts. So the kind of challenge is, an immediate challenge would be, it's either true or false that you can take products of Banach manifolds, infinite products of Banach manifolds. And I presume it's false. But it would be nice, I don't know if this is known, or it would be nice to prove that, because to me, that would be a way of saying that you can't combine infinite, that there's no physical sense of combining infinite numbers of ordinary classical systems, which would be nice to know. And a better result would be one that says there's nothing that looks enough like a manifold that allows you to do physics in it for which you can take products, which would say that no matter how you play the game, you can't take infinite combinations of systems. So that's what I know about the classical thing.
The other way around would you claim that there is an appropriate manifold, infinite dimensional manifold, in which you can do physics, but there's no either a unique decomposition of that manifold into a way of viewing that as appropriately as a product manifold?
Given a category, products either exist or they don't exist in that category.
Right.
Okay. So one category is the category of Banach manifolds.
Right.
So they either exist or they don't exist, and it's known.
Uh-huh.
Okay. If they exist, then we're in great shape, because that looks like a pretty good way of doing physics. And then our rule will be: you give me a bunch of systems, and I want to regard them as a single system. I regard each system as characterized by its manifold of states, which is a Banach manifold because it's finite dimensional. I can take products in the category of Banach manifolds. That gives me the manifold for the combination of the system. And then it will work out that if you give me the dynamical vector fields in each of these guys, that gives rise to a great big dynamical vector field in the great big guy. And in Banach manifolds, it's true that vector fields have unique integral curves.
What was the worry over there?
This is an example of a space in which you have something that looks like a vector field that does not have unique integral curves. And the question is how to play this example. And there's two ways of playing it. You can make the space be the space of CN functions. In that case, it is a Banach space, because the Banach space in the norm will carry the values of the function in its first n derivatives.
So in that case, you end up with a K that's really a Banach space. But the trouble is, in that case, you don't get a vector field, because taking the derivative of a CN function does not give you back a CN function. So if you play it this way, you get a Banach space. That's really great. But the trouble is, the obvious thing is not a vector field. So you can play it this way and use smooth functions. Okay? If you use smooth functions, then it's not a Banach manifold. Okay? But now you do get a vector field. But in space, it's, I think it's a Fréchet space or something. But in that case, it's not true that you get unique integral curves. So there's no great moral lesson here. It's only that you can play, you can imagine. The statement I'm trying to make is you have to be careful. You can't just say, well, I'm sure that it's big and it's like a manifold and probably I can do physics and maybe everything will work out, because things don't work out. So if you want to do the things that we like to do in physics, which is integrate vector fields, then you got to be careful about what manifold. And if you the manifold in which everything works pretty well is the Banach manifolds. But I'm pretty sure. So what you need, it seems to me, if you want to do infinite numbers of systems, what you in classical systems, what you need is some category of things that are like big manifolds, in which you can take products, and you have the properties that we need to do physics, like integrating vector fields. And so the challenge is to find such a category, and my guess is there's no such category. So my guess is that it's not, that we just can't take infinite combinations of systems in classical. You know, well, life goes on. Maybe we don't want to. It's not the end of the world. It seems to me it would be nice to know. I mean, it would be nice to prove. The nicest sort of theorem would say anything, given any category that remotely looks like manifolds in which there are products, then you can't integrate vector fields. That would be the best thing, because it would say, you know, this is really hopeless. I'm only doing this not because it's very interesting, but because it's nice to contrast it with a quantum case, which has a very different structure, I think.
You'd be happy, I presume, with a countable number of countable infinity.
That's a good point. You know, I see one thing. If you don't want to do an uncountable number.
I'm just thinking what theorems you might be able to find in the literature. People might have jumped off to the.
People must. Surely somebody has written down somewhere whether in the category of Banach manifolds there are countable products. Right.
I presume. I'm a little worried that they only look at finite products or arbitrary infinite products.
As opposed to continuum.
Yeah, the first 30 people who wrote on that, but certainly the 31st one must have been this case. I mean, I just don't know. I never really thought about it except for the last 2 days, just trying to get something that I could say about this case in order to contrast it with the quantum case, which I think is very strange, the quantum case. Does anyone else have anything? And this example, I mean, none of these examples are exactly germane. They're just supposed to loosen people up, right? To imagine that somehow things will work out, I claim, is optimistic. And this is a second example of imagining that things will work out. But I don't have any. We were discussing this earlier, and we were just considering the case in which this is each one of these is the reals. So that M would be the set of all M tuples. And the question is, what topology do you put on to make things work out? And we tried a few topologies which didn't seem to work. So you might think that you could get it. You might think, for example, that you should not consider the set of all sequences x, but only the sequences such that the sum of the xi squares converge, for example. But that, I claim, is a bad choice. Because what that means is that it's not the case that this system can be put in any of its allowed states, and this system can be put in any of its allowed states, and so on, such that the resulting system will have a state. Because it's not allowing all infinity tuples of x, it's only these guys. And it seems really strange to be saying, you give me an infinite sequence of classical systems, then I'm willing to regard them as a single system, but only if they're in certain specific states. Otherwise, I'm not willing to regard them in that manner. That's what this would say, which seems like, I don't know, maybe that's the way to do it, but it seems like strange physics to me to be doing that. So it seems to me if you ask for the moon, it looks like you don't get the moon somehow. Okay, so should we talk about quantum mechanics?
Okay, so recall how quantum mechanics works for finite numbers of systems. A system in quantum mechanics, at least for me, is going to be characterized by its Hilbert space of states, although in discussions yesterday, I mean, the issue arose, maybe it's better to do this whole thing with algebra, which I can't think fast enough to do, so I'm going to do it with Hilbert spaces of states. So a system is characterized by its Hilbert space of states, and if you combine two systems, one of which has a Hilbert space of states H1, and the other of which has a Hilbert space of states H2, then the Hilbert space of states of the combination is the tensor product of the two Hilbert spaces. And recall how the tensor product works. You take a typical state in here, a typical state in here, and you form a new Hilbert space whose basis, for example, consists of all pairs consisting of one basis element from this Hilbert space and one basis element from that Hilbert space. So the dimension of the tensor product is the product of the dimensions of the Hilbert space for finite dimensional case. So this is the notion of the tensor product of Hilbert spaces. And so this, of course, corresponds to the state in which this system is in a particular state, and this system is in a particular state. But more generally, there are linear combinations of these in which you have entanglements between the two systems. So that's how quantum mechanics works. And recall that the inner product between this guy and this guy is this complex number. That you get by taking the inner products of the two guys in the two Hilbert spaces. Okay, good. So now, what we want to do is, the program now is to try to take an infinite tensor product of an infinite number of Hilbert spaces, because that's how you'd combine an infinite number of systems. So let there be given Hilbert spaces H1, H2, and so on. And what we want to do is to find something that deserves to be called this. And if we can find such a thing, and if it has suitable nice properties, i.e. it's the sort of space in which we can do the kind of physics that we know and love, then that's a reasonable candidate for how to describe combining an infinite number of systems. So a typical thing that ought to be true is that if you're giving me a unitary operator U1 on this, and a family of unitary operators, and a family of unitary operators U2 on this, and so on, that from these I should be able to get a unitary operator on the tensor product. The physics of that is, if this system knows how to evolve when left alone, and this system knows how to evolve when left alone, and so on, then when I regard them as one, the whole thing should know how to evolve when left alone. That's what that means. And another thing, for example, is, given a self-adjoint operator, say, on this Hilbert space, there should be a corresponding self-adjoint operator on the whole tensor product in which A2 is being applied to this factor and nothing's been done to any of the other factors. And that corresponds physically to the idea that if I know how to make an observation on the third or the second system in my list, then if I regard the whole thing as one great big system, then I can make the corresponding observation on the big system by looking only at the second system in the list. So that ought to be true too. So the question is, can we find something that deserves to be called the tensor product and has enough decent properties to do physics? Right? Can we get the thing that we couldn't seem to get in the classical case? So let me tell you what I take to be the standard proposal for how to do this, which I think is von Neumann's or somebody's proposal. So the idea is the following, that we want to do this. We want to take one state from H1, one state from H2, and so on, and we want to consider a new state, which is going to be, let me call this the thing we're trying to construct, big H, to construct something that's going to live in big H. That's the hope. Okay. But the problem is going to be that if you try to take the norm of this guy, you're going to get into trouble because the norm can be zero even though the guy isn't the zero guy. So because you're going to, if you take a norm, you're going to have one of these products. So we start by doing the following construction. We let K denote the collection of all sequences where alpha I is in the corresponding HI, such that converges. That is to say, we consider all sequences such that the norms approach 1 at a suitable rate. Roughly speaking, if the norms approach 1, then we have some reasonable shot that this guy is going to be in the Hilbert space. And if this sum converges, that implies automatically that the product of the norms of the alpha I's converges too. By the way, when we use the word converge, I always mean independent of order. So that implies that this also converges. So you think of K as being the sort of candidates, the sort of things that really have a right to live in the tensor product because they're not malicious in terms of their norm behavior. But the problem with this is that we still can't take inner products. Because just because the product of the norms converges, that doesn't mean that the corresponding inner product expression will converge. So we therefore proceed in the following manner. Oops. In the following manner. Given two such elements of K, we call them equivalent if the sum of 1 minus alpha I alpha prime I converges. I.e., we call two such sequences of guys whose norms approach 1 equivalent if this corresponding sum converges, which means that the inner products approach 1. It follows from this that the corresponding products converge. In other words, the two guys are equivalent if you can take an inner product between them, roughly speaking. You can have two guys that are in K, two elements such that the norms of the alphas approach 1, but nevertheless such that you can't take the corresponding inner product. So an example of this would be if you let everybody be unit vectors. So let's take this guy, where these are all unit guys, then that's definitely in K. And let me take another guy, which is this. Which is also in K, right? But now the inner product doesn't know what to be, because when you take the inner product, you're getting plus 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1, and this infinite product here doesn't converge. So what we're requiring in order to be equivalent is that the inner products of the corresponding alphas approach 1 at the right rate so that you can take inner products. Okay? So we start with our sequence of Hilbert spaces. The k's are the guys that deserve to be in tensor products at all. And the equivalence means they more or less know what their inner product is. And this is an equivalence relation, I plan. So now what we do is we can do the following thing. We can look at the equivalence classes. We can look at the equivalence classes. So fix an equivalence class. Let's call it kappa. So kappa is a collection of sequences of one element from each Hilbert space, such that each of those sequences have the property that the norms go to 1 in the right way. And furthermore, any two guys in the sequence have the property that their inner product can't be taken. I claim if you give me an equivalence class, then I can build a Hilbert space out of it. And we build the Hilbert space HK in the obvious way. See, this is a bunch of guys that deserve to have their tensor products taken, and furthermore know how to have inner products with each other. But that's what you need to make a Hilbert space. So this is the Hilbert space you get by just doing the old-fashioned tensor product construction. So you consider formal linear combinations of elements of HK, and that forms a vector space, and where you impose associativity and all that other whatever you do. And you define the inner product to be this corresponding limit, which we know converges. And so we end up in that way then with a Hilbert space, which is associated, however, with a particular equivalence class. So far now we have a ton of Hilbert spaces that we're constructing from all these different guys that know how to interproduct with each other. What I understand to be the standard construction is this. You now take the direct sum over all equivalence classes. What is the word? What is the symbol for direct sum? Over all equivalence classes. And that's some enormous Hilbert space, which I believe is the standard tensor product construction for infinite numbers of Hilbert spaces. So let me tell you what it's doing. First of all, guys who don't deserve to even be tensor producted together get thrown out right at the beginning. Anybody that deserves to be in tensor products gets its own personal equivalence class, because you look at all the guys that have a meaningful inner product with it, that'll be a personal equivalence class for that guy. Therefore, that guy will be a member of the corresponding Hilbert space that comes with its equivalence class. And since we're direct summing, then it'll have a home in script H. So it follows that given any sequence of vectors, one from each Hilbert space, that lives up here in K, that deserves to have tensor products taken, it'll reappear in this fancy H guy. And H is a real Hilbert space. I mean, it has a norm and everything. So this H is our sort of candidate, about which I'm going to comment in a minute. It's a candidate for how to combine infinite numbers of quantum systems. It's a candidate which I claim doesn't work, but it's at least a candidate. And I think this is the von Neumann candidate or something.
You're just setting it to zero, basically. Is that a fair
statement? Yeah, that's right. If you don't know what the inner product is, you set it to zero. That's right. Right, because that'll come into different H kappas. And if it's in different H kappas, then when it appears in the direct sum, it'll have zero. That's right, that's a better way of saying it. That's right. So this is at least a way. I mean, in a way, it's not very subtle. I mean, you're following your nose. It's silly to be taking, to consider guys that don't even deserve to be in any tensor products at all. Once you've made that decision, then you have to take inner products. The problem is that two guys in K can have a meaningless inner product. So you consider the guys that are willing to inner product with each other, discover that that's an equivalence relation, build Hilbert spaces based on each equivalence class, and then you take the direct sum. So for example, this guy will be in script, will give rise to an element of script H, and this one will give rise to an element of script H. But as Raphael says, their inner product will be zero. Okay. So and the nice thing about this tensor product is it is indeed true that if you give me what is ostensibly a state of the first system and a state of the second system and so on. And if these are, say, unit guys, so that they live in K, then there'll be a corresponding element of script H that represents them. So it looks like, and also this has the property that if you give me unitary operators that act on the individual HIs, that will parlay itself into a unitary operator that acts on the big H. So this is a kind of decent-looking candidate for how to do quantum mechanics for infinite numbers of systems. It's a decent-looking candidate, but a wrong candidate.
Before you say why it's
fine. Yeah, you're proud. I know you're going to get it before I get to it.
No, I mean, something you said didn't seem, I'm not trying to jump ahead, but you, you said you could choose alpha 1, alpha 2 arbitrarily, but I thought they're subject to this condition that the norms go to 1.
Well, if I make the alpha 1 unit,
Well, you're making those units.
Yeah. Which is dangerously close to the point.
Okay. Okay.
Right. No, well, that's right. It's probably. So the problem, of course, is that systems in quantum mechanics are not characterized by unit vectors. They're characterized by rays. So physically, if I actually say this system is in a certain physical state, and this one is in a certain physical state, and so on, then knowing what the physical state is does not give you a unit vector. It gives you a unit vector up to phase. And the phases between these guys are completely in our freedom, because nobody tells us how to relate the phases to each other. So if you physically give me the states of the actual systems, i.e. rays, I cannot find a corresponding element of script H that corresponds to them. So even though, I mean, this sort of deserves to be called the tensor product of Hilbert spaces, it doesn't do what we want to do physically, because it doesn't tell us how to combine the systems. So now I'm going to tell you another proposal for how to do it.
The point being that the relative phases are going to be important.
The point being that the relative phases, which mean nothing in physics, got distinguished within the mathematics. Because if we don't distinguish them, we don't know how to take we don't know how to take the inner products when we put arbitrary phases on the factors. So that something that is irrelevant for the physics accidentally got incorporated into H, doing H this way. But this is the right H, I guess, if you're a mathematician and you say, I never heard of quantum mechanics, I want to take tensor products of Hilbert spaces. How do I do it? Blah, blah, blah. This is more or less the right H, because every combination that deserves to have its tensor product taken has a home. So it's a sort of the right thing. And in the finite dimensional case, it reduces to the usual tensor product. So it's not. So what is the natural mathematical tensor product, I'm claiming, doesn't work for physics?
In the classical case, you wanted some sort of universal mapping property. At least
right.
Is there some analogous thing here?
Well, the only one I know of is that if you consider.
I mean, there is one for finite, I know, that characterizes tensor products.
The only one I know is that the tensor product is a Hilbert space, or let's say, let's assume you do it for vector spaces, together with a multilinear mapping like this, such that given any other vector space here and a multilinear mapping like this, there's a unique multilinear mapping here that makes the diagram.
So does this thing continue to satisfy, I mean, does infinite tensor products?
The trouble is it's not only multilinear mapping, you have to get the norm right. And I'm not sure how you say that. Because, I mean, Hilbert spaces, I'm probably going out on a limb and I'm going to be beaten down, but I'll try it. Don't form a category.
Oh.
I don't know if that's exactly true, but more or less they don't form a category. Because you don't have sort of scrunchy mappings into, like, topological spaces form a category because you have the map that takes this topological space to this one and sends everything to a point, for example. I mean, they're sort of interesting flowing maps. But in the Hilbert spaces, you can't send this to a point because that is ignoring the norms. And so you have to put the norms into it somehow, or you're not doing the right subject. I don't know a way to make Hilbert spaces be a category so that everything works out without really thinking very hard. But I'm not claiming, I don't know beyond that. But I don't know how to do this. But maybe you can do it. And if you could, that might be a nice answer, because that would characterize, you could characterize these constructions as satisfying these universal properties. But I don't know how to do that. Maybe there's a way. That would be nicer. Okay, so the situation then is that in classical mechanics, as far as I can see, we cannot combine infinite numbers of systems. And in quantum mechanics, as far as I can see so far, we can't combine infinite numbers of systems either, for somewhat different reasons. In classical mechanics, we can't, because we can't find a context to do mechanics in big manifolds suitably defined, i.e. manifolds that actually have products and have integral curves of vector fields. In quantum mechanics, it has to do with the relative phases of the states. So now I just want to propose a way to actually do infinite numbers of systems in quantum mechanics. So the proposal is, and this is going to look dreadful at first, the proposal is, given two of these equivalence classes, kappa,
kappa and kappa prime, so these are equivalence classes of this, let's call the equivalence classes equivalent if they have representatives. So this one might have a representative alpha 1, alpha 2, dot, dot, dot. And this one might have a representative alpha 1 prime, alpha 2 prime, dot, dot, dot. If they have representatives such that these guys differ only by phase, these guys differ only by phase, and so on all the way up the line. That's an equivalence relation. So we call two equivalence classes equivalent if you can find representatives of them that differ only by phase. And now the proposal is not to take the direct sum over all equivalence classes, but the direct sum over all kappas where you have only one representative. Let's use a different symbol for this so it doesn't get confused with that one. Where you take one representative from each equivalence class. So you do this not over all equivalence classes, but one representative of each wiggle-wiggle equivalence class. That's the, so this is, let's call this script H hat. Okay, so the question is, what properties does script H hat have? Well, the bad property of script H hat is that it's not unique given the Hilbert spaces, because the problem is you had to choose from each one of the, so these are guys that really represent the same physics. So we have to choose from each one of the wiggle equivalence classes a particular element, and we take that tensor product. So if you choose different elements, you get a different H. I mean, it's isomorphic as a Hilbert space, but it's not isomorphic in the sense of its relationship to the H's. So the resulting thing is not unique. I think that's a fair way to summarize what's happening. However, the nice thing about H hat is it'll allows you to take ray tensor products, because given the rays that represent the individual systems, that has a unique home in H hat. Because H hat takes one element from each of these double wiggle equivalence classes. So the statement then is, if you build it this way, it's a perfectly terrible object as a Hilbert space, because it's not unique given the H's. But it's a perfect object for the physics, because it's unique given the rays. So this is like a sort of ray tensor product, which is, it's a strange thing, because we're used to having the Hilbert space sort of unique, and then we say, oh yeah, but remember, we're only interested in rays. What happens in this case is that you don't even get a unique Hilbert space, but it's good enough. It's unique up to rays. It's good enough to do the physics. And this H hat, I claim, has all the nice properties that you want. For example, if you give me unitary operators on each of these guys, i.e. you tell me how they evolve, then there's a corresponding unitary operator on H hat, given only up to an overall phase, which reflects those unitary operators. So if you use this way for describing the combination of systems, if each system knows how to evolve, then we know how to evolve the combination. And it's also true that given a self-adjoint operator on one of these guys, it gives rise to a corresponding self-adjoint operator on this guy. So this, I'm suggesting then, is the way, is the Hilbert space for combining infinite numbers of systems. And it looks like it's suitable for doing the job. It's mathematically ugly. It's sort of Hilbert space ugly, but ray pretty. And it, but since physics is rays, it seems to work out. So the kind of strange feature that at least I'm arguing the strange feature is that apparently we don't know how to combine infinite numbers of classical systems, but we do know how to combine infinite numbers of quantum systems, which, well, I don't want to say we would have guessed that or not guessed it, but it seems a little bit something.
Well, something. Yeah, something. So I don't. That's all. This is all I know. So I mean, again, you can ask whether there's any physics in this, and I'm not sure. But it's always. It seems to me funny that the idea of taking these infinite products works out so differently in the two cases. And I especially think that the quantum case is funny in that You have to use something that looks really awful mathematically. Choosing one entry presumably using the axiom of, these are all non-separable, presumably using the axiom of choice or something, and then build this absolutely horrible looking big Hilbert space that incredibly depends on the choices, which then is just right for physics.
But there's nothing equally horrible you can do to classical mechanics.
Well, I guess that's my question.
Yeah.
My question to you is sort of, okay, what do we do now?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think I've told you more than everything I know. So I don't know what we can find a way to do. The possible position is that you don't really want to do this anyway, which is, I think, is a fair position. You don't want to combine infinite numbers of systems. You might say, well, the universe is closed. I mean, there's only 600,000 systems. Why
don't believe that?
I don't have anything. Or you might say, position, well, I'm not sure I want to do this, but it's probably worthwhile knowing what I can do anyway, even though maybe I won't do it.
I think if you're interested in statistical mechanics of the thermodynamic limit, you do want to do something like this. Right? Because you want sharp phase transitions. I mean, you want infinite replicas, for example.
Oh, I see. In principle, at least infinite ones. That's right. Well, then I don't know, we might have a reaction.
I mean, that's not the, again, you can argue that's not really physical, but if you want clean formulations of some of the thermodynamic limits.
Well, I guess almost things that are clean tend to be unphysical in every case, right? Yeah. Like the position of a particle, for example. Well, you might not be happy with things being very non-separable, because these are massively non-separable, because you're taking big direct sums.
Also, aren't these like super selection sectors, each one? I mean, you're sort of imprisoned in one of them. Can you imagine that there are any physical processes that will get us out from one of these?
So you're saying we're imprisoned in one of these. Well, I should think if I turn on interactions. I agree, if there's no interaction, you're imprisoned. Why can't I have interactions that switch you?
Well, you might. I'm not sure. I mean, local interactions typically won't, or sort of obviously won't.
What do you mean by local?
I mean, if you make only, well, in the extreme sense, you make only a finite number. You put in interactions only among a finite subset.
Oh.
But even beyond that, so I mean that's sort of probably a triviality. But
what you're saying is, if I now pick my favorite seven of these systems and turn on an interaction that makes those seven interact with each other and leaves everybody else alone, and I can represent that indeed as a unitary operator up to phase on H hat, and that unitary operator will respect this division as a direct sum.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Right. So I see. So you could say, okay, we really shouldn't be taking the direct sum at all, unless we're contemplating turning on interactions that involve an infinite number of guys in the list. And now you could argue, well, maybe that we shouldn't be doing that. Which would that would get you out of the direct sum, and it would get you out of the non-separable character, presumably.
Yeah. So I'm not. Yeah. So I don't think you can fairly argue that you shouldn't be. I mean, if you're thinking of a thermodynamic limit, then there'll be interactions all the way out. But on the other hand,
that sounds like a nice position. So what you're saying is, I mean, let me say another way of saying it. Okay, I'm going to try to say your position. Okay, so your position is that if we've decided we're only going to turn on an interaction between seven of these guys, then we don't have to do. We will always stay in the same sector. And therefore, even though they're strictly speaking is such a formal direct sum, and therefore a non-separable guy, we're always staying in the same one of these guys so we can focus on it. Okay? Another way of saying that is, if we're only going to turn on an interaction between these seven guys, i.e. ignore all the other ones, then well, I can put all the other ones over here and regard this as two separate systems, and then I just forget about this since I'm not doing it. It's just these guys are all living their lives, and now I can just use the old-fashioned tensor product with these guys, and then I can do physics that way. I see. So is there something analogous in classical mechanics, I wonder, that says that if you're only thinking about turning on interactions between a couple of the systems, then Oh, I see. Then it works the same way, right? Then you can always ignore the other guys, and you can just take the product of these, then you don't have to worry about these issues. So I guess these issues only really arise if you're contemplating interactions that involve infinite numbers. And now you can argue whether you want to do that. Yeah, that's a good point. So maybe that's another version of the argument that we don't want to do this at all.
So maybe someone knows. I mean, the particular arena I know where this would be useful clearly would be a thermodynamic limit. And there are these, you know, spontaneous symmetry breaking or whatever. But I don't know the exact status of that statement. But I think typically in infinite, well, this is what I don't know, but in my mind, say infinite number of ferromagnets or something, like a couple of ferromagnets, then you sort of imagine that it settles down into one of these superselection sectors. And even though they're local, I mean, you have local interactions, but they're not limited to seven. They're each subsystem is, if you spin, say, magnetic moment is interacting with its neighbors, all its neighbors. But nevertheless, you seem to be trapped in some superselection.
Oh, so you're you're contemplating Chernak interactions between this one and this one, and this one and this one, and this one and this one, and so on.
There are two situations here, right? I mean, in the first case that you described, is closer to what people in physics do, open system idea. Right? You're only interested in your system, and you allow this to be, say, an hour, and I'll say quantum. And you allow interactions amongst them. You can put in potential, do whatever you like. But usually people would say, well, this is something behind that, because that enables you to separate this system, subsystem of interest, and the rest, what you call, I mean, they just do their own business. Mm-hmm. And usually that's considered an environment, and all that matters is just overall behavior on your system of interest. So that would be a more physical sort of system that contains some value down to the thermodynamic limit that you have.
And that'll get you out of this issue too, I said.
Yeah, so you don't have to be so specific about, you know, defining all these things. But the second thing that Raphael just mentioned is like strongly correlated systems that people, you know, encounter in mesoscopic physics all the time. Now there, the criteria that you can just take nearest neighbor next to nearest neighbor really is a physical issue. Okay. But people do it anyway because they can do, you know, sum over n order correlation functions. So they start with 2 points and 3 points and so on. And then you really have to be careful as to whether the part that you ignore, that you don't care, because they do their business, whether their business could really affect your business.
Right.
So that really is a physical issue. But I think that kind of separation is closer to the physical systems. It's probably more doable.
Right.
That's really more.
I see. So you might be tempted to try to formulate that in this way.
Right.
I mean, I'm virtually certain the system is useful for anything. I mean, like, I don't think anyone's ever going to work out a correlation that they wouldn't otherwise have worked out. I see. So the situation seems to be that in order to claim that you should be doing this and worrying about the corresponding question in the classical case, you have to claim more than a willingness to consider many systems as one. Right? You have to make also claims about your ability to turn on interactions of different kinds. And unless you're willing to say, I can turn on. Let's see, if you do nearest neighbor, suppose that you agree that you're going to have the systems lined up and each one can interact only with the ones next to it. That presumably is going to take you out of the sector.
That's what I'm questioning.
You
would think so. But
oh, okay. So you're
I
see.
I'm not sure I have a guess, but let me just be provocative and say that it won't. When you get a well-defined evolution, mm-hmm. it won't take you out of one of these things.
Wow. I see. So let me see. So you think of them as spins that are all lined up, and each guy gets to interact with the guy next, just the next guy. So that'll be some great big behavior. And now you're going to claim.
That can only be true if there are two quantum states where you can't get from one to the other via such interactions.
Yeah.
So
that
sounds implausible. Is it not?
I don't know. So from all spin up to all spin down, mm-hmm. can you get from that? That would be an example. Mm-hmm.
The following statement isn't true.
You have to specify that. Well,
the following statement is
the nearest neighbor. This is this nearest neighbor dynamic.
Well, from all spin up to all spin down, it's just a unitary, individual unitary on each qubit, right? So that's.
Yeah, that's not a.
That's not a problem. You don't even need any interaction to get one.
Yeah, you don't. Well, that's right. You can give the individual dynamics to take your own.
Is this true? Given a Hilbert space and given a one parameter family of unitary operators thereon, starting with a given state psi, apply the whole family to psi to get this curve in the Hilbert space, and now take the span of that curve, that the resulting Hilbert space is separable. I.e., you never can get out of being separable by evolving starting from a single state with a one parameter family of unitary guys. This is supposed to be germane to this issue because.
Well, as he said, you could just without interactions, you could go from one sector of this to another, just by rotating each.
Oh, each got one. Each got. Yeah, I see.
That doesn't necessarily get you out of. It doesn't necessarily make that you explore a whole non-separable.
Right.
Subspace. Or does it? Maybe it does. Oh, it does actually. Because each angle is its own k, isn't it?
You're gonna let the Hilbert space be some non. So let's see. So you're gonna let the Hilbert space be some non-separable Hilbert space.
And it's an external thing. It's an external.
And you're just gonna do a rotation in the individual. But then it seems to me that the corresponding curve will have a separable span in that case. Because I'm not forced to take the other combinations that you get, where you only rotate one and not the others. I'm only forced to take the curve that you get by evolving the one state and taking its span in the Hilbert space. If this statement were true, then we would have a good argument that we only have to consider separable Hilbert spaces, because the universe presumably is a Hilbert space. There's an initial state. There's a one parameter family of unitary guys. Its span is separable. And so why consider the other ones that you can never visit?
But I agree, that would be a good argument, but I'm a little worried that this is non-separable, because if you take all spin up,
yeah,
and then they all spin at 45 degrees, mm-hmm, isn't that two different sectors of your...
Oh, well, it may, but we don't have to take whole sectors in this conjecture. And if you're turning everybody, then...
What I mean is there are orthogonal to each other.
So I want to claim that if the one parameter of unitary transformations is in fact a circle,
yeah,
then the statement is true.
Okay, but how do you claim?
Because let's consider the initial state psi and the 90 degree rotation on psi, and then I claim that those two together span the entire span of the curve, so it's a two-dimensional Hilbert space, which is definitely separable.
A big qubit.
Yeah, so then I'm claiming this is relevant to your example where you turn everybody in the same way. I don't have to consider whole sectors for this conjecture.
Yeah, I agree with you on that.
Yeah, in this case, but what about is the general state?
Like cluster expansion really is what's doing this, right? Rather than single spin, you say two nearby nearest neighbor or next to nearest neighbor. Mm-hmm. And then you would be considering that as a unit, which of course is unseparable.
Right. But if this statement is true, can we parlay this statement into some general claim that we never should consider non-separable Hilbert spaces ever? Because I claim the entire universe can be described by a separable Hilbert space. So everything else is just fancy talk. I think the statement's true, too.
But I think now maybe that one parameter group is not continuous that you define. I mean, here's what I'm worried about. Take all spin up.
That's going to change things.
All spin up and then all spin at 45 degrees. Aren't those two states orthogonal to each other?
That's okay.
In this Hilbert space. But I mean, in a qubit, that's certainly not true. So the only orthogonal, just a two-dimensional.
Oh, I see. You're claiming it's not continuous. So let me claim.
The orthogonal one is that whole
you would expect a large collection of qubits.
So let me claim a proof of this lemma, of this lemma in the continuous case.
Okay.
So you take given the one parameter family of unitary guys, let's do it only for rational values of the parameter. That gives us, starting with the initial state, some countable collection of states. Let's consider the span of that as a Hilbert space. I claim on the one hand it's separable because it was generated by a countable number of vectors in a Hilbert space, and on the other hand it contains the entire orbit because of continuity of the unitary operator. But now if you're going to play the game by going to a non-continuous family of unitary guys, usually we don't do quantum mechanics that way.
Yeah, so maybe we can claim that this evolution will... So the issue is whether this evolution is physically...
Which you're really asking the question, is it true that given unitary guys on these individually, that that gives rise to a continuous family of unitary operators on script H?
And apparently it doesn't.
Ah, so that's a good argument against script H. But, which is good because we have a general argument against any non-separable Hilbert space, right? The argument is there's a unitary family, continuous unitary family for the world. There's a state, initial state. Let's apply the unitary family to the state, take its span as a Hilbert space. By theorem, that's separable. The universe never gets out of that, and therefore everything the universe can ever occupy is in a separable Hilbert space, so why fool around for the rest? Right, and now, so it's good because the two arguments dovetail together, right? So this is bad on two counts. It's bad on account that it's non-separable, whereas we've now agreed that, you're crazy to be doing anything non-separable. And it's also bad, as you point out, because if you take the unitary guys on the individual ones, even though it gives rise to a unitary guy here, you're losing continuity. I see. So this sort of fits pretty well, that's fine. I don't know where it leaves us with respect to taking infinite combinations of systems, but it does seem to be a real argument that you only should be using separable Hilbert spaces. Everyone understand this argument? So we're claiming given a continuous one-parameter family of unitary operators on a Hilbert space, possibly a non-separable Hilbert space, take any one state psi naught. Look at the curve that you get in the space by applying all the U's of this family to that continuous curve. Look at the span of that. Look at the intersection of all Hilbert subspaces that contain that curve. The resulting thing is always a separable Hilbert space. And therefore, there's some separable Hilbert space outside of which the universe can never get. So why fool around with the rest? That's the argument.
Where we assume that the evolution is a continuous.
Yeah, right. Right. Yeah, right. And your claim, Isaac, and you claim an example show that if it can still be a one-parameter family, but if it's not continuous, then this result fails, which is good because the proof fails too. So that's reassuring. Yeah, I see. That's nice.
Well, it'd be nice to know what this thermodynamic situation really is. I mean, you know, a system of spins with nearest neighbor interactions.
Yeah. How
does it come? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm beginning to be very down on the Hilbert space now anyway, so.
Yeah. But because
it's such a basic property.
I think people, what they typically do is I think you referred to you were talking about this yesterday. They typically don't work with the Hilbert space so much. They work with the algebra.
Right.
Local algebras, algebra generated by all the local algebra. Some big C startup. Some big C startup algebra.
Well, then they build the Hilbert space by taking state.
Yeah.
So that, I don't know what, if any, of this survives into that framework. But I'm not sure I want it to survive anymore. I mean, if we don't have this property, right?
The continuous property you're talking about, I'm not quite sure I follow. Because it's desirable for an infinite dimensional Hilbert space that any two different states are generically orthogonal, which is your argument against continuity.
Right.
But if
you mean for a non-separable Hilbert space?
Yeah. But at this point of all the qubits going from up to 45 degrees, for example, I mean, the more qubits you have in a string, the more orthogonal those states are, right? So, generically speaking, two different quantum states of a very large number of systems are going to be very, very nearly orthogonal.
Yeah. So you're saying we should take the position that the one-parameter family of unitary operators on the hyperspace of states for a system shouldn't, we shouldn't require continuity of that. Because if we agree to consider many systems as one, we lose continuity. You're saying that's
not sufficiently mathematically apt to make that claim. But I'm saying that I'm expecting, as a physicist, states to be generically orthogonal in large dimensional global spaces. And this is something I observe with a finite number of Hilbert spaces as they string together. And I don't feel paranoid that I'm losing continuity as I add extra systems, despite the fact that
I'm saying that's
going generically more orthogonal. So whether when I add the infinite system on the very end, suddenly I lose continuity.
You're okay with that. Well, that's an argument in favor of saying it is because it's doing it right there. You're right, it's taking continuity there.
Yeah, I mean, there's a difference. There seems to be a difference between taking an infinite number of spins and coupling them all together, and letting them interact, sort of, and that sort of all the dynamics is driven by their interactions, or putting some external field. So obviously, if you put an external field which is infinite, then you can turn all the spins like you were saying, and then you'll get a discontinuous evolution. But I guess the question is, what kind of evolution do you get if you don't do something like that?
But each of the systems, presumably left to its own devices, will have its own personal Hamiltonian, which will cause it to evolve. And as long as the systems have interesting Hamiltonians, I would think the same phenomenon will occur.
Yeah, that would be the same thing if you gave each one. But in the typical systems, it's not true that each one has a non-trivial Hamiltonian. All the evolution is driven by the coupling.
It also suggests maybe if we did the whole thing in the Heisenberg formulation, this whole problem disappears.
Maybe what I'm saying isn't quite fair. Because it certainly ought to be regarded as fair to put a fixed background field that you don't fiddle with. And then you're right, even there, the spins will precess.
Right. And then you'll lose continuity.
And then you lose continuity.
That's so it looks like you ought to, this argument's good, that you ought to lose continuity.
Right. Then what do we put in its place?
That's right, yeah. Well, it just says you can combine infinite numbers of quantum systems, but be prepared to do quantum mechanics in a somewhat different context than you're used to, which is more analogous maybe to the classical mechanics.
What you'll see is that there's no Hamiltonian there.
That's right, exactly.
Because you can't differentiate this one parameter.
That's right, and that comes up here because if you have Hamiltonians on these individual guys and you want to take this Hamiltonian direct sum identity plus this one direct sum identity and so on, then you have no guarantee that that sum will converge as an operator on H. So that's right.
There's also another that would be lurking there, which is. People that nowadays don't typically limit themselves to unitary maps, they consider these more general density matrix maps. And the sort of the category. What? Yeah, the class of maps that people like are the CP maps, these completely positive maps. So the question would be, and they're sort of characterized, in a sense, they're characterized by, they're consistent, they're maps on density matrices, not on. Not even on rays anymore. So the thing that characterizes them among all possible maps on density matrices is that they're in some sense consistent with composition of subsystems. That it makes sense to apply a CP map to one of the subsystems and let the other ones behave independently. That still gives you a well-defined map on density matrices.
For finite numbers,
yeah. So that's already an interesting thing because it means that in some sense you don't really have true independence anymore, even in quantum mechanics. Because if you had only one subsystem, there's no need to limit yourself to one of these CP maps. But if you have in mind that there are other subsystems out there, just their existence in some sense forces you to limit the dynamics of the subsystem to be of this special type. So that's a different sort of point. one might argue against a strong separability that it's not really natural to quantum mechanics. But anyway, so that's one, but then that's, I think, an interesting philosophical point. But there is this technical issue that comes up. Does that same thing survive in your, in your infinite
right device? Yeah.
Can you now put an arbitrary CFP map on each
right
subsystem and get some well-defined evolution for your infinite density matrix?
I don't have a
feeling
that well.